Speaker!
Order, order.
There are 7 political parties in the current parliament, representing a spectrum going from one extreme to the other, left to right. But with this parliament, like the last, it helps to swap the spectrum for a spirit level, with a bubble in the middle that shows which way the House is leaning at any one time. In this parliament, the bubble moves left or right depending on the views of 3 MPs, Te Uru Flavel and Marama Fox in the Maori Party, and United Futures Peter Dunn. All 3 are electorate MPs, and their combined party vote in the last election is tiny in relation to the decisive role that they can play in the House. Last week, they withheld their support for the government's Employment Standards Legislation Amendment Bill until the government caved in and adopted amendments advanced by Labour and supported by the Greens and New Zealand First that purged the legislation of wording allowing 0 hours contracts or their equivalents. Their 3 votes were critical to National, which even with the ACT Party's David Seymour was one short of the 61 needed for a majority, and to the 3 main opposition parties, which with a combined tally of 58, were 3 short of the magic 61. By accepting that if you can't beat them, join them, National avoided a vote on that bill, and the 2 Maori Party MPs and Peter Dunn were not required to choose sides. This week, though, the bubble moved back the other way, when Marama Fox cast her party's 2 votes with National to defeat a members' bill.
Our decision that we have come to has been a decision that we have made and had great debate about within the Māori Party and is no way influenced by the government in this instance.
It nevertheless saved the government from another defeat on a members' bill, a fairly innocuous one on the surface, amending the Act that established the Environment Protection Authority, the EPA, to add a clause making it plain that the authority's purpose is to protect, maintain and enhance New Zealand's environment. While Parliament is no stranger to tautology, the layman might wonder what an Environment Protection Authority might do other than protect the environment, as noted by Labour's Wigram MP Megan Woods in Wednesday's second reading debate.
Mr Speaker, never before have 7 words produced such hysteria with the government in their reaction to this bill. The simple trying to insert into the Environmental Protection Authority's legislation the fact that it should protect the environment.
Ironically, the government picked up on that argument, saying that protection of the environment was such an obvious goal for the EPA that it didn't need to be spelt out in a special purpose clause. National also believed that there were better ways of achieving the same end, a view shared by Marama Fox.
This bill, in and of itself, to change some wording, I don't believe, and we are of the opinion, will not go far enough to ensure that that happens. So we look at to the other bills that are surrounded, that have some effect in this area.
Most significant among them, for Marama Fox, was the Resource Management Act, currently the subject of intense scrutiny in party caucuses as the government tries to build a majority for its proposed amendments. They're in the Resource Legislation Amendment Bill, now with the Government and Environment Committee, on which National MPs used their majority to recommend that Meka Whaitere's EPA Amendment Bill not proceed any further. Drawn from the members' ballot almost exactly a year ago, it was sent to the committee after surviving its first reading by 61 votes to 60, the bubble moving its way thanks to Marama Fox's Maori Party.
We normally support the introduction of bills to first reading so that submitters can come.
Of the 206 submissions, all but 8 supported the bill, but that overwhelming majority in the committee room evaporated in the chamber when the bill was reported back for its second reading on Wednesday night. It was defeated by the 62 of National, ACT and the Maori Party, defeating the 59 of Labour, the Greens, New Zealand First and United Futures Peter Dunn. His vote could be critical on the next Members' Day, scheduled for Wednesday, April the 6th, if the Healthy Homes Guarantee Bill No. 2 comes up for its first reading, which it's likely to do, as it's now at the top of the members' order paper. It's Labour's second shot at legislation ensuring that every rental home in New Zealand meets minimum standards of heating and insulation. The first bill, in the name of their housing spokesman Phil Twyford, failed to pass its first reading back in March last year after National's Northland MP Mike Sabin had resigned, reducing the total number of MPs to 120. And the debate ended with National and ACT dead-heating 60-60 with Labour, the Greens, New Zealand First, the Maori Party and Peter Dunn. A second bill, this time in the name of Labour's leader, Andrew Little, was drawn from the ballot last October, but immediately ran into trouble after the Speaker decided it was not sufficiently different to get around a rule preventing defeated bills coming up again in the same calendar year. Mr. Carter threatened to rule it out of order if it came up for debate before Christmas, drawing an angry reaction from Andrew Little and his chief whip, Chris Hipkins. Their comments in the media implied that the Speaker, who's a National MP, had been trying to save his party's government from the embarrassment of a defeat in the chamber, with the opposition's ability to muster a majority restored by the election of New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters as the new member for Northland. Complaints that the comments raised questions of privilege were referred to the Privileges Committee, although Mr. Little subsequently apologised to the Speaker on the last sitting day of the year.
In recent weeks, statements have been made by members on this side of the House about you, which reflect upon you, and I wish to draw to the attention of this House that correspondence has gone to the Chair of the Privileges Committee today, accepting that those comments were unparliamentary and expressing regret for them.
The Privileges Committee's report, recommending that the House accept Labor's expressions of regret, was tabled in the Chamber this week. Privileges Committee reports are usually debated the day after they're tabled, but the Business Committee decided that wasn't necessary in this case. So everyone lived happily, if not ever after, at least until the next sitting week, which is not until after Easter. And for a preview of that week, here's the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee.
When the House resumes on Tuesday the 29th of March, the government will look to make progress on the New Zealand Business Number Bill and first readings of the New Zealand Horticultural Export Authority Amendment Bill and the Wildlife Powers Amendment Bill and also progress on committee stages on the order paper.
Mr. Brownlee delivering his weekly business statement on Thursday before question time, when he was required to answer for his Prime Minister to defend Mr. Key's failure last December to reveal that so-called jihadi brides travelling to Syria were leaving from Australia, not New Zealand.
As New Zealand citizens, it doesn't matter where they leave from. If they pose a security risk to New Zealand on their return, then that is something we are concerned about.
Mr. Brownlee's Cabinet colleague Stephen Joyce, meanwhile, answered questions for Finance Minister Bill English, including this one from New Zealand First MP Fletcher Tabateau.
Does the Minister not think that his current apathy and silence on New Zealand dairy farmers opens this government up to the very reasonable label of fair weather friend?
The Order, the Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Well, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, I think there are some parties that could be called fair-weather friends of the dairy sector, but it isn't this one, Mr. Speaker.
The nation's cow cockies found themselves at the centre of a tug-of-war as news of lower milk prices on Tuesday had the government and the opposition vying to be their best friends in times of hardship. This question for the Prime Minister, John Key, from opposition leader Andrew Little.
Will he just level with me for a moment and tell me whose side is he on? New Zealand dairy farmers or the overseas-owned banks?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm on the side of New Zealanders 365 days of the year. That's how the House wanted higher health and safety costs. These are the people that don't want irrigation schemes, don't want the RMA reform, don't want free trade agreements. Mr. Speaker, this is a joke. These people are not the friends of the farmer. These are the people that are trying to put them out of business.
What of honesty?
Mr. Key himself nearly got put out of business by the Speaker.
Order, Prime Minister. If you want to remain for question time, stop interjecting when I'm on my feet.
And the Labor leaders' attacks on banks and their interest rates prompted Finance Minister Bill English to kick off Wednesday's general debate with this confession.
I never thought I would say this, but I'm missing Russell Norman. Russell Norman, long gone to run Greenpeace, was a moderate, sane, predictable economic voice in this House.
And with Bill English telling the Greens' former co-leader to come back, all is forgiven but not forgotten, we leave the debating chamber for the committee rooms and Rhys Lyon.
A government commission study on the costs of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has been labelled flawed and an embarrassment by economist Dr. George Barker. Speaking to the Foreign Affairs and Trade Committee's treaty examination of the TPPA, Dr. Barker criticised the author of the study, which formed the basis of the government's cost-benefit analysis around copyright provisions in the trade deal.
So the study was done in 2009 by an Australian economist, Henry Urgas, and only released in November. As soon as I saw the number that the government was citing based on that external report, I realised it was just didn't pass what economists call the laugh test. It's the equivalent of saying to someone, what's 1% of New Zealand's population, which should be around 400,000, and they come back and tell you it's 400 million. It's literally the same mistake. It's not a question of assumptions or technical economics. It's just an arithmetic error, fundamentally, and a big one, an enormous one.
Dr. Barker alleged the error grossly overestimated the costs of copyright term extensions in the TPPA and ignored their benefits, and had been missed by government officials.
And the point to make about Urgas is they never had Urgas' study peer-reviewed, and now they can't find the data. So I've asked for the numbers to cross-check how he made the mistake, because I think he put the decimal point somewhere in the wrong place. But the ministry is saying they can't find the data. His company has gone bankrupt. It went bankrupt in 2009. It is an enormous embarrassment as a Kiwi living in London to have to front up and explain to people what the New Zealand government is doing here.
Dr. Barker urged the committee to recommend the government correct the error.
Because it's been picked up around the world. New Zealand government estimate is now being quoted in Europe. The media around the world picking up this number. And because it says in the national impact analysis, the New Zealand government conservatively estimates, it's just feeding the argument against copyright and the anti-copyright movement. This is literally a mathematical error, and it's time to admit it.
Director for the Centre of Law and Economics at the Australian National University, Dr. George Barker. And another submission on the TPPA came from Smoke Free Coalition Executive Director, Dr. Prudence Stone, who questioned the effectiveness of the trade deal's restrictions on tobacco companies suing the government through Investor State Dispute Settlement, or ISDS, clauses.
Some in my sector have called this a major win. The Smoke Free Coalition believes this win is not major but hollow. An ISDS carve-out for tobacco does nothing to prevent the tobacco industry from financially supporting state-to-state disputes, as Philip Morris currently does now to ensure Indonesia, Cuba, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic dispute Australia's plain packaging legislation for tobacco products.
Dr. Stone warned the government against the pressures of tobacco industry lobbying.
It is cynical to cry out for foreign trade protections when you're a multi-billion dollar multinational corporation with more resources than the governments you ask protections from. It is the public's health and the environment that need protection. Protection through strong regulation of industries that will not conduct their business ethically. If it hurts their bottom line, we must remind ourselves, bottom lines don't have hearts and minds. They are profit margins that are not as important as people.
Smoke Free Coalition Executive Director Dr. Prudence Stone speaking to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on Thursday. A day earlier, the Government Administration Committee heard submissions on a members' bill in the name of Labour's Sue Moroney calling for an extension of paid parental leave. While the passing last week of the new employment standards legislation will see an increase in paid parental leave from 16 weeks to 18 weeks, Ms. Moroney's bill aims for 6 months paid leave. UNICEF's Deborah Morris-Travers told the committee that 26 weeks was the ideal period for breastfeeding mothers.
I don't actually think that there's an argument that can be made against paid parental leave, given all of the evidence in favour of it and given the very clear public health benefits of enabling that 6 months uninterrupted breastfeeding time.
Ms. Morris-Travers explained the benefits of higher breastfeeding rates.
We've got a real problem, actually, because we've got lung infections at a rate of 7 to 8 times the OECD average, and children with scarred lungs, because they're not breastfed and because they're living in cold, damp, mouldy houses and in poverty. So there's a real interest economically.
UNICEF's Deborah Morris-Travers speaking to the Government Administration Committee. Meanwhile, the Local Government and Environment Committee has called for submissions on the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary Bill, which passed its first reading last week. The bill's aim was outlined by Environment Minister Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, this bill delivers on the proposal announced by Prime Minister John Key at the United Nations last September to create a fully protected marine area around New Zealand's most northern territory of the Kermadec Islands. This area is 35 times the area of the total of all the existing 44 marine reserves and 50 times the size of our largest national park in Fiordland. It's not just the size that makes this initiative significant, but the outstanding geological and biological diversity of the Kermadecs. It contains the longest arc of underwater volcanoes anywhere in the world, and it descends to a depth of 10 kilometres deeper than Mount Everest is tall. The depths of the ocean combined with the underwater volcanic activity makes an extreme environment of pressure, of temperature and mineral content where unique forms of life exist that are almost as fascinating as studying life on another planet. The marine life includes over 6 million seabirds of 39 different species, 35 different species of whales and dolphins, 3 species of sea turtle, all of which are endangered, and over 150 species of fish.
But concerns about a lack of iwi consultation over the ocean sanctuary were raised by Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox.
We are unhappy that the rights of the 58 other iwi who have been granted rights for quota during the fishery settlement have been ignored. In fact, I think the minister has been negligent in actually not consulting with them face to face. I fully recognise that he has been to Mana Whenua, the people who border that area of Ngāti Kuri and Te Ao Pōuri, and they have been recognised with places on the board. I recognise that my learned colleague and minister, the very able minister of Māori Development and not Māori Affairs, will be able to appoint someone to represent the rights of those other 58 iwi. However, the minister should have had discussions with them. And for the reason that they didn't want to discuss it with anyone or announce it before it was announced to the world, actually just doesn't wash. You have a contractual agreement through a fishery settlement for these 58 other iwi who have interests in this area, and that should, as my learned colleague Mr. Rawiri Seymour has pointed out, be compensated. So let's have a look at that. We think that suitable compromise achieves sustainability, and we need to ensure that iwi are included in that conversation. We have neglected to do that in the 58 other iwi, of which we could go into, but that would take all day. The proposal extinguishes iwi customary and commercial and non-commercial rights, which is contrary to the Crown's duty to actively protect a settlement. Now, this is no small thing. If we think that we can just go back on any settlements that we've had to date, then we're going to see a whole lot of furore in this nation over previous settlements that have been done and declared full and final. And yet the Crown has compromised their duty to protect the settlement as part of its treaty responsibilities in this case. Notwithstanding, we agree that this is a beautiful sanctuary, and all it would have taken, I'm sure, is to have a conversation with the affected iwi that are involved, who have now had those rights extinguished through this bill. The proposal put to Cabinet states that the quota held by Te Ohu Kaimoana on behalf of iwi is an administrative quirk. That's what they've described the settlement of the fishery settlement, which has been in place for quota in this country for some considerable time, as an administrative quirk. Well, I'm surely hopeful when Kahungunuki Wairarapa's settlement comes to this House that it will not in some future date be referred to as an administrative quirk and dismissed as quickly as this has been. As a result of the process... This contradicts the process conducted in early administration to analyse where fish stocks should and were introduced into the quota system in that area. So, as a result of that process, Māori Fisheries Act provides for Te Ohu to hold quota until commercial catches can be assured. Now, I'll say it again, this was not well done. The Minister should have gone to the people and conducted a full and thorough conversation with them and been adequately compensated because of the extinguishing of those rights.
Earlier, though, Nick Smith had sought to allay iwi concerns with an assurance Māori would be represented on the sanctuary's governing board.
The board is proposed to include a representative from Ngāti Kuri and Te Apori, the two iwi, with a statutory acknowledgement, as well as a third member to be appointed by the Minister of Māori Development, noting other iwi also have an interest and connection with these islands. Four members are to be appointed for their skills, their knowledge and experience to support the work of protecting the Kermadec. I want to conclude by generously acknowledging those who have long advocated for this protection. Ngāti Kuri and Te Apori, this bill is about securing a better future for our oceans, and I commit it to the House.
Environment Minister Nick Smith. Marama Fox, meanwhile, explained why her party would vote in favour of the bill's first reading.
I'm happy today that we are going to support this to first reading, as same as my learned colleague, the lovely Dawidi Seymour. But we would be looking through to the second reading for these things to be fleshed out further. The select committee process under which submissions can be made, I fear, will be vigorous. I'm sure that iwi will take up the opportunity to put their case forward. All of that could have been avoided had the conversation been had in the first place. And so, Mr. Speaker, it is with some trepidation that we support this first reading and that we support the bill through to this stage. Happy that we're going to have a tonga for all of Aotearoa to enjoy, but let's just do our homework properly so that there's nothing to come back on in the later years and we find ourselves having to relitigate this entire issue. Nō reira, te mana whakawā, nei te mihi atu ki a koe.
Marama Fox, now from fish to logs and questions to the Primary Industries Minister from his Labour shadow, Damien O'Connor.
Does he have confidence in his Associate Minister for Primary Industries?
The Honourable Joe Goodhue.
On behalf of the Minister, it's still yes.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, has the Associate Minister raised with you any concerns about the 6,000 jobs lost across the forestry sector? At the same time, the harvested volume of logs has increased by 50%.
The Honourable Joe Goodhue.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, as I was as Minister when I was the Associate Minister, also the Minister with responsibility for forestry, this is an ongoing issue for the forestry sector. So Minister Goodhue and I have actually discussed this. However, what we do know is that there are more logs being processed in New Zealand than ever before. That's a higher value than logs going out. So the other things that this government is doing is certainly assisting and supporting the log processing sector so that there is a higher value coming back to New Zealand's workers.
There was also this question from the New Zealand First Benches.
Supplementary question, Richard Prosser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister, can the Minister confirm to the House that logs exported from New Zealand ports by vertically integrated foreign-owned forestry companies who own cutting rights in New Zealand and sawmills overseas actually earn New Zealand anything in terms of direct net foreign exchange?
The Honourable Joe Goodhue.
On behalf of the Minister, yes.
And back to the Labour benches and these questions from Labour's Stuart Nash.
What has his Associate Minister proposed to remedy the problem in Gisborne where Malaysian-owned Hikarangi Forest Farms refuses to guarantee logs to a locally owned sawmill, rather preferring to export them, even though the mill owners are prepared to pay export-equivalent log prices?
The Honourable Joe Goodhue.
On behalf of the Minister, it will come to no surprise to this side of the House at least that this government is not going to get itself in the middle of a commercial arrangement. We will not require any owner that is harvesting logs to supply at any particular cost to any processor.
Logs for your mates.
Order.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Stuart Nash.
Has she expressed any concern at all that Hickarangi Forest Farms may lose its internationally recognised Forage Stewardship Council certification because of its refusal to guarantee the supply of logs to a local sawmill? And if not, why not?
The Honourable Joe Goodhue.
On behalf of the Minister, Minister Goodhue has not raised that with me.
And from logs to wine now, and the Geographical Indicators Wine and Spirits Registration Amendment Bill passed its first reading last week, its purpose explained by Commerce Minister Paul Goldsmith.
In New Zealand, the main user of geographical indications is the local wine industry. Geographical indications used in New Zealand wines include such terms as Marlborough, Martinborough and Gimlet Gravels. Over time, as an area's reputation grows, the name adds value, and New Zealand wines already attract a premium in foreign markets, and we want to preserve that and build on it. And it's worth taking a moment to reflect on the amazing progress that the New Zealand wine industry has had in the last decade or so. It was only in the late 1990s that the New Zealand wine exports broke the $100 million barrier, and it's now worth $1.5 billion in exports in the last year and rising fast. And that's part of the diverse export economy that sustains our living standards here in New Zealand. And the TPP, with its promise of improved market access, is a boost to this industry, and we've heard a lot about that over the last few weeks. This bill will also help, Mr. Speaker. If I can go give a bit of background, the WTO agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, otherwise known as the TRIPS agreement, obliges New Zealand to provide protection for geographical indications for wines and spirits. Geographical indications are currently protected in New Zealand by a range of measures, including the tort of passing off, the Fair Trading Act 1986, the Trademarks Act 2002, and the relevant provisions of the Australia-New Zealand Food Standards Code. The Geographical Indications Wines and Spirits Registration Act 2006 provides for a registration system for geographical indications, but this act is not yet in force. It was passed in anticipation that New Zealand would soon begin negotiations on a wine agreement with the European Union. However, negotiations never began. At the time, the local wine industry did not have an interest in registering geographical indications, so the Act was never brought into force. More recently, however, Mr. Speaker, the local wine industry has become concerned about the potential misuse of New Zealand geographical indications in export markets. This misuse has the potential to adversely affect the reputation of New Zealand wine, which, as I've said, commands a premium price in export markets. And the further that the premium grows, the further the potential for misuse increases. The risk can be mitigated by registering New Zealand geographical indications in these export markets. However, most countries will not register geographical indications unless they are registered in their country of origin. So as a result, the government has decided to bring this Act into force. An additional advantage of bringing the Act into force is that it will support New Zealand's interests in launching free trade agreement negotiations with New Zealand and the EU.
Commerce Minister Paul Goldsmith.
That report from East Lyon. Friday was Brent Smith's last day as Parliament's Sergeant-at-Arms, retiring after 14 years in which he missed only 1.5 days due to illness. I'm Tom Fruin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.